So any points arising from your review? Anything you still want to query? Not sure about? Yes? Yeah? Oh, handbook. I haven't brought my handbook. Yeah. Got it. Yeah. Can't see exactly where it says that.
It's the lines. So it has the lines.
Oh. The diagonal lines. Yeah. So that's actually on my diagram as well, or the one that from my teacher. It's actually on there as well. Don't know if that makes this a bit clearer there. Fractionally. Yeah, we haven't even strictly gone through the names of the paths yet, but yeah, when you get within each path, path of accumulation, preparation, path of seeing and so forth, then you have subdivisions of those. So I was a bit afraid it'd be too frightening. But anyway, you're sort of going, asking questions about those divisions now. So, on the path of seeing, you see, it begins when you enter into your direct realization of whether it's emptiness for a bodhisattva, personal selflessness for the hearer, so forth, whatever it is, your ultimate truth. So then, at that point, you actually do begin to abandon your afflictions, the grossest level of them. So you can't say you've abandoned ignorance until you are, you know, just passing over into enlightenment or nirvana, but you can say, you know, even on the path of seeing, which is still quite away from your actual nirvana, you have started abandoning for good at least some level of your delusions, your afflictions. See what I mean? So you abandon those afflictions sort of gradually or serially, in other words. You abandon the easiest to abandon, grossest level first, and then you abandon the sort of very subtlest level right at the end of your path of meditation, just before you're going to become enlightened. Anyway, so you go through those stages. And so when you're in the meditative equipoise, sort of directly realizing emptiness, this is how your path of seeing begins. So, at the first section of that, the first interval of that, you are on the uninterrupted path. So at that point, you are dealing with that level of delusion or affliction or ignorance and associated other afflictions. So that's the actual process where the wisdom has now become so powerful, it doesn't just sort of temporarily suppress those afflictions, but it actually removes the gross level of them such that they never arise again. So the uninterrupted path is where that process is going on. So you can't say you've actually got rid of them. It takes some time for any action to be performed after all. So that's the uninterrupted path. But when you finally sort of not just what they say is not just thrown those afflictions out of the door, but you've bolted the door so they can't get back in again, you know, so you've actually achieved the abandonment, then you're on the path of liberation. So you're liberated from ever having to be bothered by the gross level of delusion again. So that's your first of your true cessations. So you've ceased, those delusions at that level have ceased to occur in your mind. So you've got rid of them and their seeds at that level. Of course, the subtler level of delusions, you've still got some subtler kind of, clinging is or attachment or, that's still there. But at least one level you've got rid of. So the time of you are in the process of abandoning in uninterrupted path and continuing on from there, it's still the same meditative equipoise, it's still the same meditative session, but when you've got rid of them so that they won't come back again, you've shut the door and bolted it, then that's a path of liberation. So you have several series of those up through the path of seeing, path of meditation. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, that was. Well, I would have said, but not a bit hesitantly, path of accumulation. Small path of accumulation, you can sort of drop out. You know, your bodhicitta can fade away. So you can become discouraged, and drop down to say a lower vehicle. For instance, if you're on the path of Mahayana path. But by the time you got to the middling path of accumulation, I think you are it just goes on increasing then. So you just go on making progress. There's something called signs of irreversibility. You know, if you read through, it's one of the topics on the fourth chapter, the signs of irreversibility can occur on the path of preparation, path of meditation, different times, but that's something different. Actually, you're unable to fall out. You know, you are irreversible in the sense you won't drop back out of your vehicle. You won't drop back. Is something different. It occurs a bit earlier, as far as I know. Yeah. Well, we want to have the special insight as well.
So this is for special insight.
All our sort of investigative, analytical type of meditation is geared towards special insight, broadly speaking. But we have to investigate and know what karma abiding is. You know, you have to do some study of that first. Even so. Yes, so you want the power of concentration, which karma abiding will give you, and then you want the insight into primarily emptiness, but, the unsatisfactoriness of cyclic existence, the four truths, and, you want to know where you're going, how to do it, and all the special power and importance of bodhicitta to make sure that you are fulfill your potential of going into the Mahayana vehicle and just instead of just being content with your own personal liberation. So all of those things are things to study. It could be included under special insight. Somebody's thinking that karma abiding is just it. If you have that, you're enlightened or something.
Someone's thinking that without it, it's not quite
Ah, okay. Yeah. Well, you'd have different teachers and would have different approaches. Some people might say, yes, first of all, try to get calm abiding and then take it from there, because when you have that mind, you know, maybe you're much more, mind's much more disciplined and settled and able to, you know, investigate subtle things like emptiness much more easily. But that's generally not the way that it's been put over to my ears. I was reading Geshe Sopa's commentary on Tsongkhapa's Lamrim Chenmo, you know, the great treatise of stages of the path, and he says, first of all, you study emptiness strongly, you know, and you build up towards the realization of that. And once you've realized emptiness, then you really concentrate on calm abiding. You deepen your understanding of emptiness through, you know, bringing more and more power of concentration to it. So that's obviously the way he preferred to do it, or the way he did it himself, probably, you know. A sort of more kind of intellectual approach or analytical approach. But yes, I guess you get other people giving other ideas. But they say calm abiding on its own, your mind is becomes very still. So that isn't particularly a mind on its own in the beginning stages where analysis comes very easily. So if you want to understand emptiness, it seems there's no question you have to use a bit of analysis. Other people might disagree with that, I don't know, but certainly Tsongkhapa tradition, you arrive at your understanding of ultimate truth by, you know, training the mind of reasoning and, you know, investigating. But if you've got calm abiding, your mind's so still and placid and, you know, and maybe very concentrated, not wavering, but it's not kind of on its own a particularly suitable mind for, you know, subtle thinking. So you have to train to be able to unite the calm abiding special insight. So you have to have calm abiding, and then you have to try to start using it to analyze and think about something, for instance, you know, what is the nature of subtle suffering or emptiness. But then you'll find you drop out of the calm abiding because your mind is busy thinking about something. So then you try to meditate, then you try to do your thinking bit, and then you try to have calm abiding while you're thinking. You try to bring the concentration in, but you find it very difficult, because when you're thinking, it's like the mind is active and, you know, moving from point to point. Therefore, it seems a bit distant from calm abiding, which needs stillness, you know, and a steady kind of unmoving object. But gradually, by bringing them both together, you make your mind of calm abiding kind of, what do they call it? Suitable, what's the word? Pliable, yeah, a word like that. Serviceable, something like that, you know. So you get them both working together. Yeah, there's a mental factor called pliancy, isn't there? So, yeah, so you have then, when you brought them both together, you have that sort of special extra pliancy or, you know, serviceability, so that they can have both at the same time. So that's fantastic. So that's when your mind is really becoming, you know, suitable for the path. And so that's when you enter the path of preparation, when you have those two. But it's not just having those two together, but those two and meditating on emptiness. You've already realized emptiness conceptually by that time. So when you're able to realize, meditate on emptiness, think about emptiness with the union of those two, then you're entering the path of preparation. Emptiness for the Mahayana student, for the student of the lower vehicle, could be selflessness. Yeah, so that's definitely a milestone on the path when you get to that point. That's a crossover point from path of accumulation to path of preparation. So, are you anywhere near? Steffi. Ah, okay. In the Prasangika view, that's a consequentialist view, which is, you know, we're taking Tsongkhapa as our key guide in this. He'd say, no difference. For the consequence list, they're all the same realization, you know, no inherent existence, no true existence anymore, no substantial, nothing is substantially existent or substantially established. Any more of those? Any established, sometimes they talk about established by way of its own characteristics. That's another one that keeps coming up. Yeah, so all of those are prasangas, they're no messing, and are ultimately existent. That's another one. So nothing ultimately exists. So they're all the same, you know, it's all the same refutation of the same thing. But they say for the Svatantrikas, is autonomy school, things are a little bit different. Yeah? So it's you know, they say things like a bit wacky, but a bit sort of subtle. They say things like things inherently exist on the conventional level, but ultimately they don't inherently exist. So that's how that's even in Shantaraksha's poem, isn't it? Since they exist inherently in neither singular nor plural, in ultimate reality they're without intrinsic being. So, I don't know if he's saying conventionally they can have intrinsic being, but not ultimately or something, you know? So, they're using the words slightly different sometimes, at least in Tsongkhapa's interpretation. Yeah, so don't necessarily take all those things which appear to be, as it were, synonymous in consequentialist school to be exactly the same in the autonomy school. The autonomy school has a slightly different, slightly grosser level of object of refutation. So the consequentialists say nothing from the side of the object. It's very simple. Everything is merely imputed from the side of the mind. But the autonomy school, as you can see from that little phrase that we were using as the object of refutation in our kind of handout there, it's more like a two-way thing, yeah? The thing does have an inherent existence from its own side, but only through the power of being posited by, you know, the non-defective mind. So it's like there's we call it the nitzog. It's like the collection of two. Yes, there is something from its own side, but only by virtue of, like everything else, being posited from the side of the mind. So they try to have their cake and eat it. Yes, to the prasangika, say that's nonsense. You know, that's a consequence of this. Saying, yeah, that's evidence that you are, still having some subtle clinging to some kind of, own nature, inherent nature. So it won't do, you know. But that's somehow they're saying that. Like ultimately, yes, there's nothing exists. But, you know, on the conventional level, inherent existence can be posited or something, you know. So to the consequentialist, it's a bit... it's not quite there. So you can draw a little bit of put a little bit of a bit of space between the autonomists and the consequentialists. But it's controversial, you know. The other masters say that's Tsongkhapa's, you know, drawing distinctions which aren't really there. You know, accusing him of being a bit too subtle. But that's their position. You see, all the schools below. The consequences are saying you've got an insistence on something existing by way of its own nature inherently. And that's true even of the autonomists, because although they're saying, yes, everything has to be posited by mind, still it can only be posited by mind if there is something from the object's own side there as the basis for the positing. And the consequences say, no, there can be nothing from the side of the object, which is the object you're positing. The whole point is, you're positing the object in dependence upon a basis of imputation, which isn't the object, you know. So, some subtle differences. So. Nothing from the object side, which is the object. Yeah. So there's no Jane from the side of Jane. There's only, you know, five aggregates. Oh yeah. So there's dependent arising. Yeah. But the prasangikas are saying if you're going to posit Jane over there, you know what you're positing Jane on is not Jane. Jane's the positing from the mind side. But the other schools are saying, yes, but there must be something from Jane's side, which is Jane, to make the positing valid. Otherwise, we could posit Jane, you know, in dependence upon Alison's aggregates or Fred's aggregates, or, you know, we could posit Jane anywhere we liked. So there has to be something from the Jane, from the side of Jane, which is Jane somehow. You know, some DNA of Jane. Then we can posit, you know. So there's a... There's some subtle differences, yeah. So they're not easily explained all at once, and far from understanding. But yeah, so what is means the same thing for the consequentialist, true existence, inherent existence, necessarily going to be the same for the other schools, autonomous. There will be some differences. Yes. Well, you know, if you have something like, I don't know, just trying to think of a good example, that's all. Maybe bicycle is a good example. No? If there are wheels there and handlebars and a chain and you know, a saddle, and then you know, put them all together, that's a suitable basis for imputation. A bicycle, yeah? But somebody who tries to impute bicycle onto you know, a cabbage, you know, or cabbage leaves and sticks of celery and pieces of tomato, then that's just crazy, yeah? So that's not going to be able to carry them, you know, to along the road as they pedal along. So that's not going to perform the function of a bicycle for you. But you look amongst the pieces of cabbage, lettuce and celery in the salad, you don't find any bicycle. So you look amongst the pedal and the chain and the wheels and the saddle and the handlebar, and you don't find any bicycle. So they're the same in that respect. From the side of this collection of parts, the basis of imputation, no bicycle. But nevertheless, one can be a correct imputation, one can be, you know, just a wrong consciousness, foolish imputation. So there doesn't have to be something from the side of the object to be, when you're imputing correctly. But that's what all the other schools think. So if there isn't anything from the side of the bicycle, which is the bicycle, how can you say that that's... You know, so that's at the point where they see the consequences view as nihilistic, you know, that you're destroying the whole object of knowledge by your kind of radical nihilism, you know. Because we're clinging on with our fingernails, looking into the void. Well, in fact, they're the ones who are being nihilistic. They're the ones who are making a great mishmash of objects and knowledge. Only if there's dependent arising does the world work. You know, only if there's dependent arising does cause of suffering and afflictions and karma give rise to suffering, you know, and the cause of happiness, you know, virtuous actions and you know, wisdom give rise to happiness. So if everything is inherently existent, just existing by way of its own side, nothing can have any influence on anything else. Nothing can ever change. If the fire inherently exists, doesn't need any fuel to keep it going, does it? It just burns because that's its inherent property. It doesn't rely on anything like fuel, so the fire would just burn forever. How would you put, buckets and buckets and buckets of water on it, but it would still keep burning because it's not burning in dependence upon conditions, it's just burning. Yeah? It's just got burning by way of its own power. So how suitable is that as a way to describe the world? So they're the ones who are making a mess of things. Prasangikas are just showing, you know, just releasing us into, you know, if you want dependent arising, everybody's going to accept cause and effect, then you have to reject inherent existence. They're incompatible. Anybody else have a question? Say that again, I can't quite hear you.
Is karma fighting necessary for getting uncontrived qualities?
I would say no. Because uncontrived bodhicitta is the bodhicitta you need to enter the path of accumulation, the first path, to enter the Mahayana. It's the gateway to the Mahayana. When they talk about the bodhicitta in need, I think they're talking about that, you know, uncontrived. But I don't think they insist that you have to have karma abiding for that. Same, you don't have karma abiding to realize emptiness. But again, there might be some discussion, but generally speaking, that's what I've heard. Difficult minds to generate, mind of enlightenment, renunciation, emptiness, but realizing emptiness, but karma abiding don't think is essential. Even at the uncontrived level. Do you have a question?
Something about those different vehicles of life.
Yeah.
Accessing the beach or not. So I'm back, mentioned before, I remember Dalai Lama saying he'd met a monk, a Christian monk, who realized emptiness.
So, oh, really?
Yeah. So he came out of this meeting, I think it was some kind of hermit. And he said he knew then that this person, there was somebody said in the universe that the person was doing this. I remember the Dalai Lama saying that he met this Christian monk once, and I think he was some kind of hermit Christian monk, and he came out of this meeting with him in wherever his cave or place was, and said that he realized there was something that he said from that, he realized emptiness. So I was wondering how necessary it is, like for example, to avoid the cheat to realize emptiness.
Not necessary. The people on the hero path don't have bodhicitta, but they meditate on emptiness. Well, no, can't say that in this school. Yeah, that's true. In the autonomy school, in the consequential school, it'd be a bit different. But yes, even in this, this presentation, they say some sharp-minded hearers can realize emptiness. And if you look on the diagram on the page 33 of the handbook thing, then you've got number one, inferential realization of emptiness by sharp faculty trainees. That's happening before they enter the path. And this is the path of somewhat of Mahayana lineage. So this is definitely, you know, Mahayana realizing emptiness. So they've got somebody realizing emptiness before they've generated bodhicitta. So they say that's the sharp faculty people. I don't know. More intellectually gifted or something, so they go and realize emptiness before they realize before they develop bodhicitta. But the followers of a different kind, followers of, you know, more more guru devotion or more faith or something, they with their stronger devotion, they develop bodhicitta first, and then while they're on the path of accumulation, small path of accumulation, sometime then they develop a realization of emptiness. Yes. Obsessed, I don't know. Focused on, maybe.
Is that a fraction? Like,
on a lower path, on a path of the individual vehicle. I don't know what the autonomy school says about that, but if you remember the consequences of this school, they say definitely that, that the hearers do realize emptiness. So in the final view, they are realizing emptiness on the smaller, on the individual path. So it just realization of emptiness doesn't awaken in them, you know, this impulse towards bodhicitta. But of course you can change paths, you know. I mean, we say you don't drop down. So somebody who's got to the middling level of the path of accumulation, by that time they're steady in the bodhicitta. So whatever happens to them, even if they get chopped into pieces 100 times, you know, they still can keep their bodhicitta. So they never waver. But somebody on a lesser path, like on the individual vehicle path, they can go through path of accumulation, path of preparation, path of seeing. But then they might decide, yes, that actually the Mahayana path is more fulfilling or something. So they might be persuaded by a teacher or imprints ripening or whatever. So then they can switch to the Mahayana path. Even somebody who can get to the hearer's nirvana or the hearer's final stage, the path of no more learning. So they can say they can get that far, and then they can enter the bodhisattva vehicle. So that's quite possible. So there are cases of people. Yeah. So you get to the end of the hearer's path. You get to your nirvana, and then you enter. Then you generate bodhicitta. So you enter the path of accumulation of the bodhisattva vehicle. So. Paradoxically, you're already a superior being, you know, but then you enter the path of accumulation, which is, you know, one of the mundane paths. But still, you're a superior from your hero training, but as far as the bodhisattva training, Mahayana training goes, you're still on the path of accumulation. Yeah, so you can cross like that and go on. So there are these... you know, special cases. People who can say, you know, they're hearers but realize emptiness. Must be cases.
Yes. They accept that the object they were seeing as the object of abandoning is the false object?
I guess so, yeah. Somebody comes along and persuades them that they can do better than that. So that what they've done is very good, but there's more can be done, so they are inspired, and there's so that they can abandon more subtle levels of obscuration too. Animals. Well, some animals are quite intelligent, like nagas, you know, aren't they? So there are some levels of animal rebirth which are not as obscurely kind of ignorant as the animals. Most animals we deal with seem to be in our world. But they talk more about animals and other creatures other than humans being able to generate bodhicitta rather than realize emptiness. I don't know. So when we get on to talking about bodhicitta, then what kind of bodily level, what kind of bodily state do you have to be able to generate bodhicitta, and being an animal is not ruled out. They give an example, except for these nagas. Yeah, they give the nagas as an example. But then they say, like, I think Shakyamuni Buddha are supposed to have, I'm sure this is the story we had when in our text. It doesn't mention it in that Shakyamuni Buddha, like before, when he first generated bodhicitta, when he was in the hell realms. It was a dwarf pulling along a cart or something in the hell realms. Anybody heard that story? And there's another, you know, dwarf who's also suffering and in hell with him, and this dwarf isn't able to pull his cart along, you know, so Buddha decides to help him, you know, and develops this bodhicitta on the basis of past imprints and present sympathy for somebody suffering or something. And so he generates bodhicitta in the hell realms as a hell being. Yeah. So the people, the births where you're not able to generate bodhicitta are very few. But that's bodhicitta not emptiness. So not quite what the answer to your question. But maybe we should do our recitation of the sutra. Then we have some time to just look at bodhicitta after a short tea break, up until 5 o'clock or so. Is that all right? If you have any more questions? Yeah? Well, this is a sutra layout, isn't it? Tantra is another matter. So, Ornament of Clear Realizations. I don't think there's any mention of Tantra. You know, they keep kept separate. Oh, yeah? Don't worry about Jason. John, is that enough? I don't know if that's enough. Just for this side here. So I don't know what will happen to those. You know the website 84,000? Have you been there to look? So this Dzongtsa Khyentse Rinpoche's plan to translate the Kangyur. So certain sutras have been done, and this one has been sponsored by that effort. So by my friend Gareth Sparham. So he's translated it, but they'll have their editing procedures. So whether the footnotes will stand, I don't know. It's still a work in progress, you see, when you look at it closely. But anyway, the holy bits, presumably footnotes aren't holy, it's the rest of it. So we have to think of, we're doing this as a purification practice, one of the most traditional recommended purification practices is to recite the sutras. Reciting like this in a group activity is very much the way they are recited maybe because of the monastery only has one copy of the of each volume, you know, so not everybody can have their own copy. And so everybody recites them together. And you might recite the whole of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, maybe at an auspicious time, like the month in which Buddha became enlightened, Sakadawa. And so all the monastery sits there, reading through the pages, making a jolly lot of noise, and all the noises going up to the ears of the Buddhas and delighting them, I presume. Anyway, it's a chance for us to, another way, to absorb the message of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, to get the, you know, get the feeling of them. So we can use it in a purificatory manner. So we're relying on the Buddhas, we're relying on Dharma and the Sangha as our refuge. So we're trying to align our minds with their inspiration. Bodhicitta motivation, of course, if possible. And then regretting our negative actions, all the actions in which we've dishonored the scriptures, or, you know, been disrespectful of the Buddhas or other equally holy beings, holy objects. And then all the other unpleasant actions and downright evil actions that we've done that have harmed other sentient beings, hurt others. So all those actions, whether against the field of merit or against other sentient beings, regret them. And we try to purify our minds of their effects, which are lingering in our minds. To really purify them, we must realize emptiness, but to, you know, sort of suppress or, you know, lessen the power of their ability to produce effects, regret. And then the remedy, reading the sutra, and then after we've finished, resolve not to slip into these negative actions ever again. So let's read now, read aloud, read briskly. And why? It is because the intrinsic nature